Thank God for Bitcoin podcast is brought to you by IRS GuardDog. IRS GuardDog is a tax monitoring service that alerts you to existing and even prospective problems that arise with your IRS account. I spoke with Clinton Donnelly, the CEO of IRS GuardDog, the other day, and he shared about a recent client that they had helped who hadn't paid his taxes in 6 years. I'm sure none of our TGFB listeners could ever fathom getting in that kind of situation, but he was, and he needed help getting up to date. So they took a look at his account, and through their service, were able to see that the IRS was preparing to audit him. He brought all his paperwork to Clinton and his team, filed 6 years of tax returns within a couple months, and checked his account a short while later to find that the IRS had actually reversed the decision to audit him, which saved him and his business thousands of dollars in legal fees and a ton of time. IRS GuardDog offers four service tiers, ranging from as little as $12 a month up to $249 a month for full active monitoring, consultation, fix, audit defense, and audit appeal. Clinton is a former pastor and was also one of our presenting sponsors at the Thank God for Bitcoin conference in Miami this past year. Go ahead over to irsguarddog.com and use promo code TGFB. You can find out more there and let them know that you found them via us. That does a lot to help support us as a business and ensure that we can continue to make podcasts like this going forward in the future. Chester Nay, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
It's great to see you, Jordan, online.
Yeah.
Not as good as person. But it's good to see you out in Pacific Bitcoin. That was awesome.
Yeah. No, I often tell people, for those of you who are listening, if we don't need to compare, right? We don't need to compare to others being better, some being better than others. But I have to say, if I had to say there's one person who's like the biggest person who's like just trying to like push Thank God for Bitcoin and ensure that it succeeds and you know, accomplishes its missions, it's probably you. There's been so many conversations that we've had, and you know, you volunteer for the conference, you've done a number of things. So in many ways, Thank God for Bitcoin would not be able to exist if it wasn't for you. And so I figured, man, I would love for the rest of the Thank God for Bitcoin community to get to know you a little bit. So thank you for taking the time.
Awesome. Well, I'll react to that. I mean, that's very kind to say. I can say whenever you guys put something up for sale, I FOMO in immediately, thinking that it will sell out or it won't be available. And then I'm surprised to find that, you know, yeah, the first one or whatever. I just can't imagine how folks aren't more excited about the Thank God for Bitcoin brand, and as a Christian, as a Bitcoiner, as a father, as a husband, you know, it just gets me really excited. It's kind of like there's a lot of overlapping circles, yep, that that kind of come into play there for me, and it feels like I was created to speak to some of this. It feels awesome. I love you guys. And man,
the feeling is definitely mutual. On that front, now, again, you were the first person to buy a ticket for TGFB 23, about a year and a month ago. And then you were one of the first people to snag the TGFB 1, collaboration that we did with HODLers Official, the TGFB jerseys that we
had. Oh yeah, I'm super pumped about those. I was a little, at first you were like, oh well, they're gonna be kind of expensive, and I've been stacking sats, and then I saw the I saw what they were gonna look like, and I was like, the witch is gonna kill me.
We only have a couple more, and the reason why, so they ended up being, they're like $120, which is, you know, more than we would like to, but it's just because of how small the quantity was. So hopefully we're gonna do another like a volume two, version two for TGFB 24 in Nashville, and hopefully we'll be able to order a number more and then get that price down a little bit. But yeah, so those are, if you haven't seen those, get on our Twitter and take a peek at those. But yeah, or our Instagram, I think we have a picture of them on there. But yeah, Corey, the guy with HODLers Official, killed that and did a great job. So I just want to kind of, again, get a little bit of an introduction to who you are. So what, you know, who are you, Chester, and what do you do?
Yeah, so I'm my, you know, I'm a father. I have three small kids. You know, my wife of 13 years. You know, she's amazing, and we met in the Northeast. She's from Jamaica, and you know, a lot of my stories, of course, intertwined with hers over the last, you know, better part of 15 years. We have three children, young children, you know. And so the life of a dad with young kids is quite exhausting. But we, they're awesome. We love them. Right now we're homeschooling them. When I say we, I mean my wife. I chip in, you know, occasionally, but she does all the heavy lifting. And
the royal we.
She's really fantastic. So, you know, I wouldn't be who I am if it weren't for who she is. So. Shout out to Anna Kay. She's an artist. Hopefully she's going to be joining us on stage there in Nashville too. And she released a new single a couple weeks ago, just wrapped up a concert series that we were doing. And so just taking some time off for the holidays and just trying to relax. But yeah, I work in the environmental industry. I work for an environmental consulting firm. I'm the IT director here and manage our technology practice. And our program around just delivering good service to both our clients and our internal folks. You know, we see a vertical opportunity there to support the Bitcoin mining industry with environmental consulting services. And we have, you know, nearly 20 years of consulting support and about 250 engineers all over the country with offices in Texas and Raleigh and Atlanta and Kentucky and kind of many of the places where there are mining activities occurring.
Yeah.
And we have experience in permitting and compliance related activities. And we're really approaching it from an industry support side.
Sure.
We do a lot of data center work and we're seeing a shift in data center architectures. And so just trying to increase awareness about Bitcoin mining and AI high performance compute as well, since they're kind of bedfellows in that regard. They both require a pretty power dense situation. So just trying to get people educated at my firm and in the industry and among the regulated community. And I'm just getting really started with that. We've been out to a couple of conferences, just doing some reconnaissance and connecting with other industry participants. But it's been really, really great to be involved with that. And I'm trying to do Bitcoin where I am, you know, rather than, you know, jump ship and go to some industry thing. Like, I feel like there's value to be built here, and I love building things. So, yeah.
And so you guys work with, I mean, like policymakers, like you, I know you've gone down to some of the different Bitcoin related forums that have been down in Washington, D.C. and, you know, had some conversations with, you know, elected officials and people, you know, working in the policymaking side of things.
Yeah. So that would be the Bitcoin Policy Institute. They're doing a fantastic work down there. A lot of really intelligent, gifted people who are trying to get in front of our elected politicians to just share the truth of Bitcoin mining. There's really a pretty strong counter narrative with Greenpeace US and a number, you know, you see what Elizabeth Warren is coming out with, and you know, anti-crypto army and Gensler and all of that. And I think, you know, it's some of it's misplaced and based on kind of outdated information. And I love what Daniel Batten is doing and Troy Cross and Margot. They're really getting out there trying to share good quality data sources. Yeah, I think the data wins in the end, but like there's just a lot of FUD around some of these things right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we want to help with that as well. You know, we have connections in the regulated community as well. And so, a lot of questions though. So
it's, I can imagine it could be a tough road to hoe. why don't you do this for us? Again, when one of the first times when we first met, at the TGFB conference in 2022, you were incredibly generous. Actually, man, this is pretty appropriate. So this newspaper over here was from you. This is, this always happens. You do the wrong gesture, Riverside has these gesture things built in. But we have this newspaper, and you gave that to me. You know, we'd known each other for like 10 minutes, and you say, hey, I brought some of these to give away. And I think these cost like $100 at the time.
Yeah,
I think
they were like $100 a piece. Yeah. The face value is like a quarter, but you know, I was coming to 2022, and there are a few folks that I really wanted to connect with, and who I appreciated appreciate their contributions and what they're trying to build, and so Troy Cross is one of them, and you were another one of them, and there were a few folks that I connected with that week, and I just brought them in my suitcase. I'm like, hey, how am I going to say thank you to Bitcoiners who don't know me? That, you know, there's this trust thing that saw there's so many scammers, and it's like, how do you like immediately start a conversation? I was like, I know, I want to go on eBay, see if I can find these, and I bought like, I said to my wife, I'm like, all right, here's the thing though, like don't freak out. I'm going to buy like $2,000 worth of these newspapers and take them to this conference, and I'm going to give them away to people like I don't know.
Yeah.
And she's like, that's a terrible idea. It's not going to work. I was like, you don't know Bitcoiners. They will really appreciate this.
And it is. So. It's been a memorable gift that just floored me. So this is the paper that's from the actual day that the Bitcoin went live in El Salvador. What did tell everybody what the other newspaper when they first announced it? How much those are going for?
Oh yeah, you can't even find those. I mean, because like nobody really knew how valuable they were going to be, and so like the newspaper didn't print extra ones. You know, they just happened to be like the cover story that day. That people weren't scalping them and saving them, you know, to sell internationally. So they're really, really hard to find.
Yeah.
I've not yet found one myself.
So. I think we had seen when you gave me this one, we were talking about you had seen, or I had seen like at least one or two go for like $10,000. Like it was something insane. We're just like, what on earth is going on? Again, we met in Miami. We started talking. Yeah. We ended up going to dinner together. It was, you know, you and I and Jimmy Song and then Gabe Higgins and his wife. And so we were sitting around at dinner, and somebody asked you your story. Maybe I asked you your story, and you just proceeded to tell me your testimony, and it really just you know, Christian testimony, and it just blew me away. So go ahead and just share however much or however little you're interested in doing, just kind of your story, how you became a Christian.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a bit crazy. My mother, I love her. She went to California when she was a young woman with a man who was, you know, quite a few years her senior, and turned out that he wasn't, he was a bit of an altcoin himself. You know, had drug addiction problems kind of immediately, and our family pretty much plunged into a pretty desperate situation. My sister was born and my mother was homeless, and you know, he just was crazy, out of his mind, and the state intervened, and you know, honestly, you know, my mother barely was holding it together with two small children under the age of four. And I think I look back now, having small children of my own, I was like, that's an impossible situation. Like,
wow.
And he was very abusive to her. And so she came, kind of packed up a suitcase, and my grandparents came out. We moved back into the Northeast. That was in California where we were at then. And, you know, we had nothing, like just the clothes on our back. We stayed with my grandparents for a little bit, and eventually had gotten on Section 8 housing and had gotten a little apartment. And, you know, she had gone back to school, or was going back to school, had a little job, was just doing the single mom thing. And, you know, on food stamps, welfare, all the things, right? Like we had nothing. And, you know, there was a small church that we had attended in Reading, Pennsylvania, outside of Reading, Pennsylvania, Shillington, called West Wyomissing Chapel. And it was just a respite for our family. There were some older men there who had taken interest to me, and Kevin Arnold, and a friend of mine, and his father, and Sonny, another gentleman, played the trumpet there in the church. And honestly, they just kind of took me under their wing, and there was a youth group, and just were like, hey, this is a community, right? And so I came to know the Lord at a pretty young age, mostly just looking for a father. And so if, 5 or 6 years old, kind of accepting Christ as my savior. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was something that my testimony was very tangible. Like, it was very palpable, because we needed a lot of things, and mm-hmm. God provided those things through our church community and, mm-hmm. Directly through my mother's faithfulness as well to raise us. But, a couple years go by, she's finishing up her degree, and she remarries, and this guy's no good either, man. Oh. So it was just tough, man. I wanted to be out of the house. That she eventually got a divorce from him, and I started working, 40, 50, 60 hours a week when I was 14, and got a full-time job when I was 16, moved out of the house, and started just working. I lived with some friends for a while back and forth, and then got my own place with some roommates. And God, in my late teens, early 20s, God really brought me a good community of men that we did life with. And that was super pivotal, I think, at that time for my walk with the Lord, and helping to orient me properly. Because I was very rebellious the systems that govern, I pushed against just because of my lack of respect for authority and things like that at the time.
What were you doing? You said you got a full-time job, your first full-time job at 16. What were you doing?
Well, yeah, it was a crazy story. I was a busboy at Lone Star Steakhouse, doing line dancing and hustling with tips and stuff. And at 15, and there was a young lady who'd come out with one of her girlfriends, and she's like, hey, we're going to the beach, you want to come with? And I was like, sure. And she's like, tell me your story. What do you want to do? And I was like, in high school, I want to get a job, working for a software company. She's like, oh, my dad owns a software company. That's kind of weird. And I was just like, well, I should meet him and work for him. And she's like, okay. And she just set up a dinner at their house with her dad, who owned the software company. And he's like, yeah, man, I started building computers young, like 10. And so at this time I had like my own little consulting business building computers and doing like databases and websites and stuff like this. And he's like, wow, man, you know your stuff. And so he offered me a part-time job through an internship at my high school. And then after like 6 months, he's like, yeah, we're just going to give you a full-time job. Like, just come do our marketing, I did graphic design. I did a heavy metal magazine too.
No way.
And so, yeah. So it's called, you can look it up. It's called a Promethean Crusade. It's like a death metal magazine, not the most Christian of situations, but, it was crazy because I lived with my some dear friends who love metal, and we played Magic the Gathering and went to metal concerts and did this magazine, and so I was doing all this, and so
horrifying to Christian mothers of children.
Yeah. Oh, my mother hated it. She hated this magazine. Like, she would take, so I did the photography, and then like all the labels would like mail their photos in, like press photos and stuff like that, and I'd have stacks of like 1,000 photos that I had, that old flatbed scanner. I'd like scan them in, and then crop them and everything. And so one day, before I got to scan them in, one of our issues, she had taken all of our press photos and put them in a dumpster or put them in a wheelbarrow and set them on fire in the backyard. And we were like, that was all our content for our issue. Like, goodness. So furious. And that was one of the reasons why I moved out. I was like, Mom, I can't deal with you anymore. And I was like,
oh my gosh.
I had this job. And so I was doing this magazine. And so I found out, actually, kind of ironically, that Peter McCormick from What Bitcoin Did also had a metal zine that he did when he was young. It just came up in like an episode and we were talking about it. And I was like, wait, I had a metal zine. So he didn't like hear of it. It wasn't super big. We had a readership of a couple thousand people, close to 20,000 at its peak. But that was a big deal, I guess, in the late 90s. So anyway, long story short, I could do graphic design and CorelDRAW and some of these programs. And so I started, part of this internship was just like, hey, revamp our marketing, do our advertising, do our website. And then I started just getting into programming. And so I started programming and doing front-end user interface development. And and then boom, I was there almost 20 years, like 17 years. So
wow.
That was good for me because I was rebellious and I absolutely, God, like literally was like, Chester, you need to just work like a madman at this stage. Like you're going to go off the rails if you're not grounded. And so he provided that opportunity and it was a great opportunity for me for many, many years. And then eventually towards the tail end of that, I was, managing all of our infrastructure and support teams and cloud-based stuff. And so I opted to move to this consulting firm that I'm at now. So I've been there for about 7 years. So
okay,
but yeah, that was the impetus, is that I needed a mooring in my life, and God provided that through unconventional means.
Sure.
And it worked out. But
that church that you got plugged into, is that the church you're still at to this day, or did you guys
We moved a bunch of times. We had moved outside of Coatesville and went to a Presbyterian church for a while. Yeah. Came to Pottstown, we went to a Nazarene church.
Sure.
And then went from there to another church. Like, so I've probably been to maybe six or seven churches. Sure. The church we're at now is very much a Bible believing church, non-denominational, in Pottstown. So,
yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how you became a Christian. You have somewhat of a technological background. You're messing around with computers. What year did you get into computers?
Well,
you said you were like you said you were building computers like nine. So mid-90s, early 90s?
Yeah. So like I would say late 80s, right? So
oh my gosh, wow.
Yeah, so my first introduction was the Commodore 64 and the old Tandy systems,
yes.
Which were like way, way old. And my mother was like, because she was in school and I would go to college with her. And she was just like, back then it was like okay to just leave your kids in the library and like, tip the librarian like a couple bucks to just like make sure they didn't burn anything down.
Sure.
But like she'd just like leave us in the library, go to class, and then like I just went on the old Apple, the old like really super tiny Apple computers doing graphic design, and they had some XTs and ATs in the library, and so booting up like DOS games and like computer science guys would like design these games and then like have me play test. Like, so they they knew I was in the library and they just come down and like give me a floppy disk, be like, all right, check this one out. And I just played like, this is a problem or that's a problem. And so, I had been like seven maybe. And my son's young too. He's like this age. I just can't. Yeah, I'm like, wow, I'm now this. So it's like, it's crazy as I think back.
So
yeah. But she had the wisdom to be like, hey, like my son has an aptitude here.
Yeah.
And so she scrounged like everything together as a single mom and bought me this like Commodore 64. And then before long, I was like programming in BASIC. I was like building these little apps and games in QBASIC. And it didn't take much. Like we went to this silly group called the Brooks County Computer Users Group. I mean, if they're still around, like, good for them. But I was like, single mom, young boy, like had this interest in computers, and I'm learning like DOS commands and coming in, and they sold raffle tickets, and you could buy like for $1, you buy a raffle ticket, and then you could win like pieces of a computer. And then over the course of a couple months, maybe you get to build one. Yeah. But I just was like, they found out I was entering the raffle. So then nobody else bought any tickets. So I would serve a win like every week. And, build my first computer when I was young. And then I just got addicted to it. Like, it's just so interesting to me to build them, put them together. It's like Legos, you know? So I've been with computers since I was, as young as I can remember, really.
Okay. And so in terms of Bitcoin then, I mean, surely, you know, 2009, you know, January 3rd, you were mining Bitcoin right from the beginning, right? Is that how this worked?
Bro. So I worked at a software company.
Oh, man.
I heard about Pizza Day. I was like, knew about Bitcoin.
What is Pizza Day for those who are listening who don't know what you're talking about?
Well, that's the day. There's a gentleman who's like, hey, I want to find if Bitcoin has any economic value. And so he put out on a forum. He's like, hey, I want to buy some pizzas with Bitcoin. And he found somebody to say yes. And it's just some insane amount, like billions of dollars of Bitcoin.
Like 10,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah. It was like
for two pizzas.
Yeah. Pay for two pizzas. Right. So I'd heard about this. Back then on Engadget or Ars Technica or something, you know, forum, back in 2010. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I kept saying to myself like, oh, maybe I should look into it. Right. I had an apartment with free electricity. Right.
So, oh, man.
And it wasn't even metered. It wasn't like metered on the build, like the whole building had one meter. So there's no way they could like sort it out. So, and being an IT person, like we got rid of old server architecture all the time. So I like had like racks, access to racks of like used servers that I could have just spun up in my apartment. I calculated the financial value of the Bitcoin I could have mined if I just used my free electricity and free servers. And it made me like sick to my stomach.
$3,000. Just a few thousand. Yeah. You know,
it was like $30 billion or something. I mean, it was just an insane amount of value. So like when anyone asks you like, oh, what time? If you go back in time, what will you do? And I'd be like, mine Bitcoin with your electricity at your apartment. But yeah, I had heard about it, you know, but it wasn't. It's so interesting because in the West, you know, we have so many vehicles for financial inclusion, really, you know, like there was PayPal, there's, you know, credit cards, there's stock, you know, and I was trading stocks on E-Trade and, I didn't really have a huge amount of disposable income, but like, you know, it was just something I was aware of. Like, you know, I was just like, oh, well, I don't really need Bitcoin. Like I can just use PayPal. Like what's, it's not that different. Right. And you just kind of rationalize these things yourself, to not take the step, to really look into it. And that's like everybody's story. Like so many people are like, oh, I heard about it, but then, you know, and you get the price that you deserve, I guess is what I like to say here. So I didn't deserve that initial price apparently. Yeah. So, that's when I'd first heard about it. So.
Okay. So then once you got into it, how did you end up hearing about it and getting into like getting to the point where you were and it got to a point of decision where you're like, oh, wow, I see the value proposition here. And
Yeah, perfect. So when I started this job and my firm that I'm at now, I had an office mate who just rode me about it. He's just like, Chester, you love this technology stuff. You're like a libertarian. You love this economic stuff. Like, why don't you own any Bitcoin? And I'm like, look, I don't really know about it. And I had gotten burned on some penny stocks, you know, and just some terrible investments that I made.
Sure.
Really just quite foolishly because I didn't really understand investing when I was younger. And I was just like, I just don't really have like disposable capital that I want to just deploy in some like pink sheet garbage thing that
magic
may work
internet
out, like magic internet money. And I was just so skeptical. And he's like, no, you got to do this. You got to look at this, like spend the time. And he started like sending me resources. And it was right at the time when Peter McCormick with What Bitcoin Did was starting up his podcast. It was in, 2016. I started doing research, and then 2017, basically around the summer of 2017, around the hash, block size wars, was getting taken off. That's when I was trying to make a decision. So like, there's all this drama around the block size wars and like who's right and all these like forks, and I'm like, this is not for me. Like, there's so much drama here. Like, I don't even know anything. He's like, no, persist, keep looking into it. And, yeah. And you know, there wasn't really a lot of resources back then. Andres Antonopoulos was out there. And so his content was super valuable to me at that time. And then I started listening to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. And Peter McCormick was like, hey, I'm just going to learn in public. And that's been a bit of a sorted learning journey for him with all the frauds and things that he's encountered over the years. But like, getting plugged in at the foundation of that podcast, and then literally just ODing. And I said to my wife, like, it took about 4 months where I said, there's something here. And there's this is new. Like, this is like the internet. And I could see that at the time. And so, but we didn't have any money. We just bought a house. I just got a new job. Yeah. You know, we just had a child. And so we didn't have two pennies to rub together. And so my mother, I reached out to my mother. I was like, hey, Mom, here's the thing. Like, you got any money laying around that you would set on fire that I could? You know, and she's like, oh, I got something that I could send to you that's in my like high risk category. And I was like, all right, well, like, we're going to invest in this Bitcoin thing. And if it works out, you know, great. If not, thanks, Mom. You know? And then we levered some debt to like go all in. And it worked out wildly well. You know, whatever, that was the bull run of 2017. It was just face melting between November and the end of the year. And you, of course, think you're a genius, you know, when that happens. You're like, I am the product of all this research. And then God's like, no. And I, you know, I just like swapped for Tron and just, you know, like this Ripple and just like a, you know, just a bunch of garbage, you know, and then of course it went down, you know, like 98% or whatever. And I was just like, this was a terrible thing. This was so stupid. And I still didn't really understand it. Right. But it was at that point where I turned to my wife. I was like, look, I made a big mistake here, but clearly other people, like, there was an information asymmetry here where I literally just didn't know what the heck I was doing. And other people did. Like, there's a halving cycle that I didn't really understand this dynamic. And there's so much FUD at the time about the Chinese New Year being the reason it dropped. And like, and I was just like, yeah, that's exactly what happened. You know, not even understand. The Chinese New Year, God, and that's what it was. I'm using like algorithmic trading bots and like just hemorrhaging whatever, you know, I had left. And it was just terrible. It was just a terrible experience. And of course, I drug in some folks at work to this.
Oh, no.
You know, thankfully, they didn't ape in as much as I did. But, you know, and it's all fine now. But, like, we're all learning together. And so it was a neat time. Like, but afterwards, I said to my wife, I was like, look, man, I need to spend 2 to 4 hours a day every day until the next cycle. Like, so for 4 years. I have to make this commitment.
Yeah.
And then I got to work. Really trying to understand the technology and the markets and all the terminology. And it was just a humbling education about how little our traditional systems prepare anyone for any of this, right? Like so it's been a crazy ride. And I've been so thankful to stand on shoulders of giants who've go before and prepared content that was like really great, and so that's kind of the journey now. So fast forward a couple years, you know, now I'm trying to be more in contribution. We lead a meetup here in my hometown. I go out to the Philly John and try to help those guys out and connect with other people in the space. And I love what Thank God for Bitcoin's doing and trying to pour myself into that and. Just try to help like the next cohort that's now coming in,
yep.
you know, fresh
yep.
greenhorns and making the same mistakes. So
okay, so let me just ask you this. So again, we have people who listen to this or who will share this with people who are in a situation of they're Christians but they're not Bitcoiners. And you know, they have friends maybe who are fanatical about Bitcoin and are just disproportionately so in their opinion at this point. And you know, if you had the opportunity to sit down, or when you do have the opportunity to sit down with people and talk to them about Bitcoin, or Christians about Bitcoin, what do you say to them? Like, what is kind of your elevator pitch for them?
Well, I got to be honest, in the West, among modern West-oriented churches, it's kind of tough because you still have this kind of skepticism around, like, well, isn't it just magic internet money, right? And mm-hmm. so part of the way I frame it is, I love Gladstein, you know, his book, yes, I have over here, Hidden Repression, and his stuff about Check Your Financial Privilege is another really great book on this topic. It was really eye-opening. Like in the West, in the United States, we have all these financial instruments, and we have absolute security, you know, comparatively to everyone else in the modern world. And we don't really realize what Bitcoin fixes, like why even hard money is important.
Yeah.
And I got to be honest, like the financial literacy among the church is terrible. I mean, it's terrible among the general public, but it's bad too in the church. And there's some great resources that I've been exposed to over the years, like, you know, the Financial Peace University stuff and, mm-hmm. That kind of get you started, but like once you peel back that onion, like there's just so many systems that are impacting us that we're not even aware of. And so my first approach for a Christian is talking about just stewardship, right? So like we have our time and energy. God gives us abilities, and you know, the parable of the talents is perfect, or the minas is perfect to illustrate this, is that God gives each of us some measure of ability and talent and time, and we're expected to invest that in others, invest that in the businesses we're in, to sow, to expect a harvest, to share, to be generous, right?
Yeah.
And so what if there was some resource that you could use that would allow you to be a better steward of that investment of time and energy? And just talking about our base money and all the printing that happens and all the manipulation that happens and the real impact of inflation on that compounds over your lifetime.
Yeah.
And it's tough because Bitcoin's only been around like 15 years.
Yeah.
So people are like, oh, well, lifetime, like it's been around 15 years and like, its modern implementation is maybe 5 years. Right. So,
yeah.
It's tough. People are skeptical, but I get started around that conversation of like, what is money? And would it be better if you used a different unit of account or unit of measurement for your time and your effort as a human? Yeah. And that piques interest because people are like, oh, huh. Yeah, that's interesting. Why is it a better money? And then you can kind of get into some of the nuance. You can't really even start them like with the mining or the halving. Like that just goes shred over people. But I really love Lynn Allen's, her Broken Money book. Fantastic, right? So I've been sharing that with a lot of other believers. You know, thank God for Bitcoin resources as well. And Progressive Case for Bitcoin with some of my progressive friends.
Yeah.
So there's some just great resources out there right now that get people started. And there many of them have audiobooks too. And so I've been sharing those resources as well. But yeah, that's kind of how I start the conversation. It's just like a discussion about base money and like what people know about it.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, that kind of vibes with kind of what my strategy is and has been, which is just the, like Jesus said, those who are well have no need of a physician, right? So like If you don't see there's a problem, you're not even going to look for a solution. And so,
that's right.
You know, Jesus, like half your thing that you're working at when you're talking to people about Jesus is like you're trying to help them see that they're lost in order to help them see that they need to get found. And so I think that it's at least there's a good basis to that strategy.
And then once you're found, there's this aspect of being fruitful and faithful, right?
Yes.
And it's the stewardship really that I think is the argument or the angle that I approach with Christians is like, and this gets into some of the things we've been talking about recently about missions and how Bitcoin is a tool, a strategic tool for missions, and how like groups of people like churches or elder boards should really consider like, hey, how much is being extracted from the giving that our folks are entrusting us to? How much is being extracted in these systems? And is there a better way? Can we be more tactical with certain buckets of funds? And so that's interesting too, from a leadership perspective. Yeah. And I love that TGFB is created some resources for that too. So
what are some of those options? What are some of the tactical ways that you think about Bitcoin and you think, man, this could be something that would really help the church, in terms of being able to support missionaries, in terms of local ministries? Can you start naming off a few of those and maybe unpack one or two of them a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, think about like the value of donations given here in the United States, but then put to work abroad in another country. Missionary who's in field, I love what Gridless is doing in Malawi and things like that, where they're building these power projects with these sustainable hydro and micro projects, giving people electricity. And there's a missional aspect of that in terms of increasing their output and their livelihood and their safety and their security that makes them receptive to the gospel. Just think about micro businesses too, and education, and what's happening in that situation. Like your funds go farther typically abroad, and there's this extraction element to get the funds in country. And it kind of depends where your mission work is, but some countries are it's insanely difficult to just move money from the United States to that country. And you typically are going through a number of intermediaries who are extracting a percentage of that. That creates time. It creates a much longer time for that to happen. And that's all very distracting for the missionary who's like just trying to share the gospel, and then they're having to manage all the complexity of their local inflation rate and the conversion and the safety of even acquiring physical goods or cash to then conduct transactions. And how many times a week can I do that? And the value drops this percentage a week. It's just a lot to manage that distracts, I think, in a lot of ways. And so one of the best use cases is just a better store of value over short periods of time, and a more tactical way to get money into a scenario very quickly. And especially on Lightning, I mean, some missionary opportunities, missionary is like, hey, for $50, I can help this family in this very specific strategic situation. They're part of our congregation, but I need $50. Like, it almost doesn't even make sense to notify your community that's supporting you that's an opportunity, because by the time it's gone.
Yeah.
But with Lightning, you could say, hey, like, they can have maybe a custodial wallet on a mobile device. And there's maybe a board that's managing some local funds for strategic things like this, and they can get that to that person very quickly, and boom, it can meet a need. And so I think just the velocity of money serves as that opportunity. The other thing that I'd like to share I'm thinking about with some folks where I go to church is the ability to. Instead of having people give funds, the ability of churches to earn their own Bitcoin through heating their buildings with Bitcoin mining, by maybe they have a large endowment or someone who's given a lot of money at the end of the year, and they want to do a solar project, or they want to do something like this to reduce the operational expenses of the church going forward for energy. But then they're selling it back to the grid at pennies, And maybe, hey, let's heat our building with that, or let's heat our hot water with that. And so that's something I think that's really interesting, is giving churches and communities additional ways of earning income through mining, which I think is pretty cool.
So this would involve, because we've talked about this a little bit, so this would involve, for those of you who are like, this is a completely new thought to you, this would involve getting a solar array, like getting solar panels, putting them on the property of the church, the roof of the church, you know, whatever it is, using this, absorbing the sun's energy, and then using that stored energy to mine Bitcoin with.
Yeah.
The Bitcoin miners take in the energy and they produce heat. So then you would channel the heat to actually be the way that you heat your building. Is that, like, that's correct? That's what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, whether it be through like a vent ventilation system, or it be through a radiant flooring system.
Sure.
Both are options.
Yeah.
And it also depends, like, people are like, oh, well, then can you only do that when the sun's shining? And there are other options depending on your jurisdiction. Where I live, the local carrier basically has this net metering contract that you can set up as a business, where you are putting the solar energy in during the day, and then you can kind of withdraw it in the evening, kind of use the battery, the grid like a battery. And as long as at the end of the year, you're kind of like net zero, if you give them more, they obviously pay you, and the other is true.
So some of the benefits of doing that would be, what would they be like for a church? I mean, they're able to generate some revenue with their, with the resources that they have. So they're using, leveraging the property that they're on and the building itself.
So maybe you have a donor who's like, hey, my mother passed away. She left some money to the church. She really cared about sustainability and the viability of this church long run. She wanted to see these funds be invested in a way that would make the church more sustainable, both from an energy perspective or, from the perspective of like, hey, we get to reduce our electric bill, right? Yeah. So, hey, we're going to do some sustainability upgrades, maybe LED lighting. We're going to get a more efficient boiler. We're going to do this. We're going to put solar panels on. And so these are like sustainability improvements that might be important to someone who's like, hey, I'd like to earmark these funds for this purpose. And that could be a blessing to the church because they have less overhead cost on a monthly basis. And then with Bitcoin mining, it allows basically the board or the elder board of that church to be stewardship over an asset that's increasing in value over time. Yeah. And then they're actually mining it too, right? So there's some, like, you got to have a Bitcoiner like in that church because, as you know, mining is pretty complicated. And, I'm very interested in exploring, solutions that allow us to make that easier. Sure. And so we're doing a test project this year with about 50 kilowatts of power and about a half a dozen miners, just kind of proof of concept us out and see what it looks like. If it makes sense, we could package it in a useful way. But it's just kind of one example.
And so then what would you, so again, you've unpacked this for me, but for people who listen, so what would you do with that Bitcoin? Like, is there a strategic advantage to having, Bitcoin that you've mined yourself versus, Bitcoin that the church has gone out and bought, for example, or people have donated Bitcoin? What are some of the advantages to mining your own?
Yeah, so if you're mining your own Bitcoin, obviously, it's kind of difficult to acquire Bitcoin in a KYC free way, and especially as you can imagine.
What does KYC mean?
Know your customer. And so this is a scenario where, like, if you have an exchange account, it's just a bit more complicated as a board. You got to set up a financial account. It's a business. Mm-hmm. There are tax implications that you're managing, and of course there are still tax implications as you mine, because you're getting an asset, you're holding it on your balance sheet or in an account, right? And so there's some complexity there to think about. But, typically in that scenario, you'd have a multi-sig wallet with a number of parties who kind of hold the keys and make decisions about how those funds are spent. That's kind of the idea, is that you would you would hold it as a group.
Sure. So that's one thing that Bitcoin enables. And then what is the advantage? Like, so non-KYC, what can you do with non-KYC Bitcoin that you can't do with KYC Bitcoin?
I mean, you can imagine some scenarios that are really hairy, involving missionary activities where, like, at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, they were speaking about some of these from like a sex trafficking perspective. And, there was a young lady, I forget her name, off the top of my head, but I can provide it for you if you have show notes and you want to get it out. But,
yeah.
But basically she was using Bitcoin as a means of extracting people out of, sex trafficking and slavery. And like, you know, you got to make payments to sometimes really seedy people. And that's not something that it's very easy to do with traditional funds. And so, you know, you can see what, you know, this movie that just came out where they, that's exactly, you know, what they were
doing. Sound of Freedom.
Yeah. And, international justice, missions as well. Where they, you know, they go in and they're extracting people, you know, in cargo, you know, ships and then just really just crazy scenarios, where Bitcoin that has been mined, KYC Bitcoin is can be used more readily, in those
non-KYC Bitcoin can be
non-KYC Bitcoin can be used in those scenarios. We're starting to see some of this, OFAC, you know, filtering of transactions, or only certain mining or mining pools are approving certain transactions, which I think is kind of ridiculous when the U.S. dollars used for all sorts of nefarious things, and then they want to, like, OFAC is like hard on miners, and there's been some FUD about that that's going around too, which has been largely debunked.
I mean, Chester, it is true that Muammar Gaddafi had, you know, vaults full of Bitcoin. Oh wait, no, that was the U.S. dollar. Never mind. You're right. Sorry,
my bad. Mistake. Yeah. You know, and it is what it is. I mean, money is just a tool, right? And evil will find ways to use all sorts of the tools, and will actually look to co-opt the best tools for itself, to corrupt their application. And so it shouldn't be surprising at all that that happens with Bitcoin. But the benefit of Bitcoin is it's a public ledger, and so everything is laid to bear. Like, you'd be kind of foolish if you're running any kind of long-term operation using Bitcoin, because you will absolutely be found out.
Yeah.
I think it's quite tactical in these scenarios where you need funds to extract someone from a cartel who's being trafficked. Sure. You know, like, that's different.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tough argument to make that, especially for a Christian, that, you know, the fact that something can be corrupted, that's somehow an indictment on either, you know, on the, like, the thing itself or the creator of that thing, when humanity was corrupted and we were made by God. And so, like, the fact that happened is not an indictment on God. Like, that's, you know, God didn't do anything wrong. We shouldn't neglect God because, you know, his creation was able to be corrupted and used for, you know, illicit purposes. So, let me just kind of, let's move into, we've talked about Bitcoin emissions. We talked about, like, energy industry. For me has been one of the black box, that I never knew existed. I had no understanding of energy, how it works, how really it's what undergirds the world and the economy and all kinds of different things. Could you kind of speak to that, maybe, for people who are in that situation where, again, they know they need energy in the form of oil and gas to get around and to heat their homes, but like how does the energy market, you know, factor in all the other markets around the world?
Well, I mean, energy is an input cost in literally almost everything we do. And without energy, and you can see the comparison between modern societies and developing societies, in that access to energy at a reasonable and consistent cost is absolutely the number one thing that brings a people group out of abject poverty, right? And the multiplication power of both technology and consistent energy, in terms of productivity of a people group is amazing, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of it here in the West is we've had the benefit of access to these technologies, energies, for a very long time, And we just take it for granted that we have access to energy and that it's consistently accessible. But in much of the world, it's absolutely not, right? And so, you know, you have rolling brownouts, or hey, you get energy available from this time to this time, or it's like terribly expensive. And so I think good consistent energy is absolutely essential for human flourishing. I have a Fossil Future by Alex Epstein. You know, he talks about this, and I think it's true. You know, it's a bit disingenuous to sit here in a powerful Western nation that's benefited from fossil fuels and now is trying to kind of like make a renewable transition to then basically, you know, mansplain.
Look at these countries.
Turn around and be like, you guys can't use your own resources. Like, it's ridiculous, right? And I work for an environmental firm, and so like we have ESG teams that kind of look at this and help corporations to make better decisions around this. But the system is still very much broken, and accessibility of energy is still like a huge global humanitarian issue, and especially in the global South. And so, energy is just so important to everything that you can imagine: refrigeration, lights to extend, any kind of machine that you might need to make you more productive, a sewing machine or anything. It could be very small. Like, and many of these places, and I love what Gridless is doing, and they talk about this, is like, hey, at first, people just need like an LED light and they need to charge their phone because that's literally their only use for energy because they don't have
that. Yeah. But like, can you explain who Gridless is and what they're doing? Kind of unpack what they're doing.
Yeah. So Eric Gober, Gridless, he's, basically going into Africa and his goal there is to help communities transition, into having energy. And so they'll go in kind of previously failed hydro projects or projects that aren't super sustainable long term, and they'll install some Bitcoin mining capacity at those sites and say, you know what, on day one, we're going to buy 99% of the power that's generated from these assets, these hydro assets, we're going to buy that and we're going to turn it into Bitcoin. But over time, as the community, more people get connected to that source of power, more people upgrade their lives in terms of refrigerators or LED lighting or machines, or they can now make 6 dresses instead of 3, and they can now have 4 goats instead of 2, and they start to realize the impact, productivity impacts of having reliable electricity.
Yeah.
And that starts to kind of compound in the community. Then the Bitcoin mining is like, okay, well, next year we're only going to buy 75% of the power, and they basically be that buyer of last resort that monetizes that asset for that community and provides that capital backstop that allows that asset to continue to produce over time and make sure the equipment's maintained and the community's maintained and the relationships. And so, as you can imagine, over time, now we have 200 houses connected, 500 houses connected. And then now all of a sudden, it's profitable for the power company 50 miles away to run lines and connect it and then manage the asset moving forward. But like, that wouldn't have happened if Bitcoin mining wasn't in there being that buyer of last resort for that energy. And so access to energy is a huge, huge issue. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of people don't have access to electricity still in the modern world. And it's hard for us in the West to really wrap our minds around like the impact that, like, how that impacts regular life.
I think Bitcoin is basically what you're describing, is Bitcoin is serving as a bridge. It's like bridging the gap between people who don't have any electricity and the people who do. It basically enables the incentives to align for all three participants involved. You have the entrepreneur who's at the Bitcoin miners, you have the small people, the people in the small village who they're looking for, they would just need energy in order to increase their health, their abilities. Something as basic as, kids being able to study after the sun goes down. It just changes their life. And then obviously the electro companies have to make profits in order to survive. And so, Bitcoin enables them to get paid. So it's this perfect,
it's like a
Uber
win-win.
Yes, the win-win-win-win. It's the it's just this never-ending that you know makes this economic activity possible where it wasn't possible otherwise. So yeah, I just think that is just such a fascinating conversation.
and that's literally just the tip of the iceberg, right?
Yeah.
Some of what's also being done with Bitcoin mining as it relates to energy is anywhere you need heat, hot water or hot air to do anything, whether it's like low grade food manufacturing, any kind of chemical process, any kind of heat, can be substituted with Bitcoin mining. And depending on the energy mix of that area, it can be quite beneficial. We're seeing this too in Texas a lot in the ERCOT grid there. Sean Cottle has some great he's great to follow on Twitter. He has some really, really insightful interviews too on what Bitcoin did about the energy markets there and how Bitcoin miners are also incentivizing renewable build out here in the United States. And in West Texas, they have this pretty unique scenario where they have like incredibly consistent wind and lots of like hot days, sunny days. And then in Western Texas, there's also quite a bit of oil and natural gas. And so they're mining oil and they have this gas byproduct. And in most cases, they're flaring it. They're slowly setting this energy asset on fire. The reason why they're doing that is because the CO2 emissions are a lot better than the methane emissions and for the environment and for the atmosphere. And so they've gotten a permit that says, hey, like, we're going to just set this on fire. We can't put it in a container and get it in a truck. There's no pipeline. We're literally in the middle of nowhere, dirt roads everywhere.
So they run out of, hey, like, even if they were to put it on trucks and stuff like that, you run out of space, yeah, like, to be able to.
Yeah, and then they're like, you're spending fuel to transport it. Like, and this fuel and the person driving the truck costs more than the value. So there's not been this economic scenario to monetize these stranded energy assets. And so I love what's happening with Nodal Power, with Vespeen Energy, with and Nodal in cohort with Marathon, and what's happening at these sites. And there's some really, really cool stuff that's happening in the oil and gas industry where they're getting, you know, if they have consistent output at these wellheads, they can co-locate generation resources right there, a shipping container with some mining units. They can take that flare, they can shut it off, they can divert the gas into the generation. And they could basically monetize that asset, take something that was being set on fire and was an environmental liability and turn it into an asset. And then those funds can then be reinvested in those industries to do other things like that are helpful to the environment. And so I push against, you know, this narrative that Bitcoin mining and the environment are like against each other, because in many ways the incentive structures are aligned that they're partners. The same is true of wind and solar. Like, you don't necessarily need wind and solar at the time it's being generated.
Yeah.
And the transmission lines might be full. There might not be a demand. A lot of times they're deploying batteries to kind of soak up this extra capacity, but maybe your batteries are full too. So then what do you do with the power? It's curtailed. It's wasted. Yeah. It's not used. The wind blows, the thing's spinning, but you're not generating electricity. And so in that case, again, you co-locate mining assets at those facilities. And now those renewable wind and solar projects are even that much more profitable and capital efficient. Same for hydro, same for nuclear. It's lowering the cost of power because it's removing the volatility in the pricing. Yeah. And these operators, they shut off. They get a call. You know, it's not an actual call, but they get a software call. To shut off their miners if the power is needed on the grid, and they can do that very quickly. And they have a power purchasing agreement, a demand response agreement to do that. And so it's just fascinating all the applications, even in the last couple of years, that have come out on power and energy and how Bitcoin mining is a partner instead of an adversary. So
yeah, and I think one of the other things that I enjoy about this is, again, because you have people who they recognize how corrupt a lot of the stuff in the ESG, like the push behind these companies and how dystopian they are. And so the fact like Bitcoin is it's apolitical in this way, because it's basically no matter what side of that aisle you fall on, like Bitcoin is helpful and valuable to you know, to companies and everyday people. And like it's good no matter where you fall. Even though where you fall is a very important, you know, question and has all kinds of downstream ramifications. So again, yeah, there's lots of, you know, debate over all this stuff. And again, I have my own, you know, I'm just incredibly skeptical just given how, you know, the ESG movement, just given how everything works and what it's incentivizing. But with that being said, like Bitcoin mining and Bitcoin wins no matter what situation you find yourself in at this point.
Well, you know, I'd be remiss working for a firm that does ESG consulting to support publicly traded companies to kind of push back against that a little bit. And, you know, to be fair, right, a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of greenwashing in the industry. There's been a lot of double spending of carbon credits, and there's just been a lot of fraud and a lot of altcoinery, as we say, in the industry. But I think if you boil it down, companies, individuals and companies are wanting to be more, I would say, be better stewards, right, of the resources that they're using. They want to have more visibility in their supply chains, you know, and it's quite inconvenient that the bulk of cobalt that goes into making lithium ion batteries is mined in the Congo by children, right? Like, it doesn't matter how many shell companies you package that into, like that is the reality.
Yeah.
And so it's like a lot of these like green solutions just kind of sweep that under the rug.
Green for who?
Green for who? Exactly. Yeah. Like, what do you mean? Like, what's the S and the G here? Like, what are we talking
about? Green for me and not for thee.
Green for me, not for thee. Right. And corporations understand this, like, you know, and supply chains are incredibly complex. And there is legislation coming that is really going to require any SEC traded firm to disclose their emissions and their supply chains. And you know, we do those energy audits, we do those reports and things like that at our firm. And I think you know, we largely partner with companies who are interested in just having a transparent conversation around that, being honest about it, and then wanting to pass that on to their constituents. But like at the end of the day, like, just like there's a crazy amount of garbage in the crypto community at large, there's a lot of usury, there's a lot of people that are trying to manipulate the narrative, and there's all sorts of messaging out there that's not factual, that's not true. The same is true, I'm sure, in any industry. But I don't think I think the proof is going to be in the pudding, especially after this upcoming halving in April, where the mining reward gets cut in half. It's going to really force a lot of Bitcoin miners to be thinking more strategically around their energy agreements, around their access to stranded renewables and stranded energy assets. It's going to force this to have additional revenue streams. Hey, we're going to use the heat to grow tulips. We're going to, you know, grow fish with the heat. We're going to do this other thing. We're going to, you know, and so it's going to force a lot of creativity. And more of these stories are going to come out. Because at the end of the day, Bitcoiners need cheap energy, right?
Yeah.
And cheap energy is generally energy that's being misappropriated already. So I just love it. And I think more positivity is going to come out around all of this.
It makes sense. It does. What it is for me, especially the Texas example. I mean, the fact that there's been such instability in Texas, in their Texas electrical grid, because of how intensely they've gone in investing in, you know, quote unquote, renewable, also the other way to put it would be non-reliable energy sources. You know, they've invested so heavily in that they've literally had blackouts. Man. They've literally had blackouts in Texas, of all places. And like Bitcoin is helping that. So part of me is just like, part of me is like, okay, great, you know, Bitcoin's helping it. But at the same time, it's like, is Bitcoin mining helping to paper over something that would otherwise have worse consequences and potentially provoke, you know, a more drastic action on the part of states and different entities?
Well, that's a great point. And I'd like to speak to that for a second. So like the ERCOT's unique in that it's a separate grid, And they can do some things in their grid that many other grids cannot due to the isolated nature. Texas is also basically a different country. You know, people are just willing to try things there where they may not, you know, and people ask really, really tough questions. The regulators in Texas have been very open with the mining community in Texas. And there's some pretty cool things happening there with the North America Blockchain Council. And some Bitcoiners are like, oh, get this stuff out of here. But like, I got to be honest, like grid scale mining is very different, right? And so than cowboy mining. And I think what's going to come out of all of that is that ERCOT's really leading in terms of how do you do this? Like if we were to export this to the rest of the country with these more more complex situations with distribution and generation, you know, what might that look like? And they're really pioneering that for the country. You know, they're bringing on more renewables, more wind, more solar than anywhere else in the country, and they're like proving how this can work. I think that we definitely need a solution. I think baseload nuclear is absolutely the solution in this country. There's some fantastic things happening around nuclear energy with some of the small modular reactors and some of the fast fuel reactors. It's just like leaps and bounds above what's been happening.
In terms of efficiency
efficiency.
Productive and power.
In South Korea and Canada are kind of leading some of that development. And there's some great, great podcasts out there on that.
Can anything good come out of Canada these days, Chester? Yeah. I don't know about that. I don't know if I believe it.
If we have a renaissance and it comes out of Canada, I was like, all right, I could forgive some sins because we honestly, I know it's a tough ask, but I gotta, you know, like we have a real problem. Like, you know, in most of the world, base power is either natural gas or coal. Like these are not carbon neutral activities. Yeah. And whether or not you think the carbon neutrality is even beneficial or how you feel about climate change and carbon, it kind of doesn't matter. The nuclear solution is just way better.
Yes, it's better no matter. Again, it kind of supersedes.
It just sidesteps the whole conversation because, you know, and largely we've let our foot off the gas, pun intended. on this topic,
you can tell you're a father. I'll tell you that right now. That's top shelf.
Oh yeah, that's top shelf dad joke there. But like we've let off the foot. Like you know you think about like how much good could we have done with $7 to $10 trillion of printed money if a large percentage of that had been invested in just like hyper focused development on these nuclear assets. It just pains me to see. Yes. So much money having been spent, and we literally still have, we don't really have reliable baseload. And a lot of these generation assets are becoming older, and you see stories now of them being taken offline and brought back online for miners, and there's all sorts of conflict around that. And we're seeing some of that in our industry.
Go ahead. I was just going to ask, so you had said like there's coming down the pike, there's new regulations that you have to disclose your emissions. Like, do you still see that happening, even though things like BlackRock, they've stopped like their ESG fund? There definitely does seem to be a backlash happening. How much of that do you see? What are your thoughts on that?
So yeah, that's a great question.
And I'll just add one more a little bit. So like as inflation goes up, right? And as these things get more expensive and people face like existential crisis, you know, it's one thing for politicians to pass laws in a vacuum and in a moment, boom, we can get this done. It's another thing for those laws to be able to be either constitutional, B, you know, to be able to endure where there's not like outcry once people realize the consequences of having to live with the consequences of those decisions.
Yes.
What are your thoughts?
Okay. So some thoughts about that. So like, regardless of whether or not that people are going to be legislated to provide this reporting, right?
Yeah.
there are a lot of folks who are like, you know what? We want to be good stewards of our supply chain. We want to be good stewards of the environment. Yeah. We want to be good stewards and to serve our constituents in a transparent way. So we're seeing, some of the firms we work with are opting into this.
Sure.
Kind of in spite of kind of where the direction of it is now for their own information, but then also because their investors think it's important or, their leadership thinks it's important. I think what is interesting, kind of ironically, about the ESG movement and about these extra scope 2 and 3 emission reporting requirements, which require you to basically disclose the energy mix of the energy source that you're using and attribute to that to your activities. So if, for example, you're in a jurisdiction where most of the energy is produced via coal, then like your activities, that's coal on you, bro. Companies are like, wow, let me think maybe more holistically about our whole operation. What can we be doing? There may be a jurisdictional arbitrage situation where you're like, hey, let's go to a jurisdiction that uses more nuclear so that we can get this benefit here. And it's just people are thinking more strategically about it. It brings visibility into it. So I think it's going to happen kind of regardless of whether or not there's legislation from the SEC that requires it, regardless of whether it's being pushed by.
If you're talking, especially like you're saying, if you're talking about if the thing in question, if the thing we all agree is the most efficient is nuclear and we go to nuclear, well, then just by extension, that's just, it is ESG compliant. Even if you think it's the biggest crock of garbage you've ever heard. But again, it kind of just,
I think it's going to happen. And this is in fossil future, this is one of the arguments that is made there is like, hey, over time, as technology increases, as accessibility to technology increases, it's all deflationary, and the risks of climate disasters, of loss of human life around these things, it reduces over time. And I think it's just painfully obvious that the future is nuclear from a baseload. It's like nuclear plus some renewables. You want to make wind and solar panels, fine. You want to get some hydro, fine. You want to do nuclear, fine. But like, let's have a good, healthy mix. Let's have some software that's balancing that. Let's have some industrial level applications that are taking power, that are shedding power. And I think that's what the modern grids are going to look like. Is they're going to be mostly carbon neutral anyway. So I think we're already trending in that direction. And maybe, and I don't know, I'm not a BlackRock guy, so I don't really know what they're thinking, but they may be kind of looking at the trend and saying, you know what, we're heading in this direction. This is really the only sensible path. Maybe our job's done here, right? Now, of course, they want to launch an ETF product, so they're probably like, hey, we can't be FUDing Bitcoin and
ESG.
Selling. Yeah, we're going to be depressing our bags here. So. Yeah. That might be part of it too, and that's above my pay grade to talk about that, or at least have an opinion that's informed about that. So there's lots of voices out there. Well, I mean, time will tell on what the ESG thing looks like.
But definitely,
I think some companies are opting into it, and that's would be my takeaway.
Yeah,
and that there is value in stewardship and transparency.
I think one of the reasons we're still friends, Chester, is because. Even though we might differ on this point, is because again, I do think you do have this tension of being in the situation where you're like, this is the world I'd like to see, but this is the world we actually live in, and so trying to figure out what to do in those situations is difficult. It's complex, and you're trying to do act in the best.
At the end of the day, if there's a snowstorm and there's no sun and there's no wind. And you got to ramp up gas peaker plants at some obscenely expensive, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And so it's the devil's in the details. We all want to virtue signal that everything's fine and dandy. But at the end of the day, we're firing up gas peaker plants to meet the demand.
Yes. At the end of the day, again, this is the thing. Human flourishing is the goal. And so we're going to do whatever, you know, whatever we need to for human flourishing. I think another part of this, and this we could go a long time talking about this, and we won't, but is just looking at, I mean, how much of a lot of the fear around this is like eschatological. Like it's like you have people who have like convictions or a lack of convictions about you know, what the end of the world will look like, and so that drives some of the,
is it getting better or is it getting worse, right?
Yes. And like in what, and just like the fears associated with like, you know, could we just explode in a ball of, you know, whatever, like could we melt ourselves out, like all these things, like there's far more going on than just data that's informing. Data has to be interpreted and you know, data has to be filtered and made sense of, and the way that you do that is with, you know, different philosophical and, you know, different everyone has underlying meta narratives and underlying commitments that shape their you know, how they see the world, how they process information. And so the lack of recognition of that can make conversations challenging of people who have different accountings.
Yeah. And that's true. And I just kind of go back to what I was saying about technology being deflationary, right? Like the cost of goods and services to produce with raw material inputs going down over time as technology and energy becomes more abundant. And I think a lot of these larger scale narratives that they want to just like completely ignore the fact that like the average, you know, quality of life is improving as the access to these things improves. And so, yeah, I think, you know, we live in abundant times and I think that, I think that's good for human flourishing. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, cool. Well, Chester, thank you so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it. And again, this will not be the last time. We'll have to have you back to talk about AI. Hopefully that episode isn't censored by our AI overlords at some point in the future.
We better do it quick.
Well, cool. Well, Chester, tell our audience where people can find you online. And yeah, just kind of whatever else if there's anything else you want to plug, your wife's work. You said your wife was an artist, and I'm guessing people picked up on this, but she's a musician. Tell people where they can find her as well.
Yeah, so for me, I'm on X / Twitter. Ginger Sherpa is just all one word. Ginger Sherpa is me on there. I'm on Noster as Ginger Sherpa. You can hit me up on Strike for Lightning as Ginger Sherpa, and Telegram Ginger Sherpa. Everywhere is Ginger Sherpa, basically. and then my wife, you know, her name's Anakay. Anakai, AnakayMusic.com. And she's on Spotify and Apple Music. She has a really beautiful single that we just released, and we're working on getting out a copy of her live Christmas concert that was just a couple weeks ago. And she'll be at the, Lord willing, at the Thank God for Bitcoin event in Nashville.
Mm, we have some, let's go.
Really exciting things planned for that. Hopefully they pan out from our lips to the Lord's ears. So just feel free to give me a follow on Twitter and reach out. Happy to chat with anybody. We do have a local meetup here in the Northeast. Plug Bitcoin John if you want to check that out on Telegram. And we have some pretty great folks coming up. Jason Mayer is going to be coming out, Progressive Case for Bitcoin, to the January John in a couple weeks. And so that'll be pretty cool. Bring your progressive friends. and so that should be cool. And so looking forward to that. But yeah, that's what's coming up in the short term. So
cool. Awesome. We also, if you guys are out there, and Chester just mentioned the TGFB 24 conference in Nashville, go grab your tickets to that. Ticket prices are going to be going up in January. You can grab them at tgfb.com/store for $250. That is a 2-day event. Again, we love our friends over at Bitcoin Magazine. Yeah, we love our friends at Bitcoin Magazine. Our conference would not be possible without them. But the signal ratio for the price, you cannot beat it anywhere in the Bitcoin world. So I'll say that. Go grab your tickets before the prices go up. the last thing I want to mention, Chester, tell the story that I always tell everyone about your wife and her singing ability that you found out you were recording with. She was recording with some of Nina Simone's.
So my wife, she's a very multi-talented music artist, but she sings jazz like heaven gifted at singing jazz. And so we're in a recording studio in Spiro, recording studio in Reading, Pennsylvania. And we're recording her Father EP album. And, you know, we had some really, really talented world-class musicians there working with us. And it was really exciting. And we're behind the recording studio and we're looking at the waveform of her, the spectral view of her voice as she's recording. And she does most of her recording in one take. You know, they're just like, okay, let's go. And then the vocals are done. And then we're like, let's get a couple just in case, you know, we have them. And it's just really, she has this unique ability to just basically be so consistent that the second time we ran the vocals, you could literally just like hold the spectrum views up over top of each other. And it was like the same. So it was pretty cool. I just love that about her. She's super consistent and just such a faithful woman. So hopefully some of you get to hear some of her music I love it. So I love recording. I love being involved with her gifts as well. So yeah, man, thanks for the plug.
No, of course. I always tell this because it's just crazy. She was recording like some of the musicians who were there, like were musicians for Nina Simone, and they just were incredibly complimentary of her voice. Like, yeah.
You're amazing.
That's so cool. So hopefully you guys will meet Chester and Anna Kay and a bunch of their friends who we will hopefully be able to divulge later. We're grateful for you, Chester, for all your help and work with TGFB. And we'll talk to you soon.
God bless. Thank God for Bitcoin.